You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 311, Exodus 35 through 40. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. We got, as we're recording this, two. Today's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, in 2 days, really on Monday the 10th, the new school starts. So everybody on this end is like just chomping at the bit, ready for this thing to start. We had the Unseen Realm film premiere this last, this is Wednesday night. And there were a lot of people, you know, from the community, you know, who came to that and told me they had signed up for the school. And so everybody's ready to go. And, you know, I am too. So I'm just kind of, you know, waiting for it to start. Yeah. Wait to get into the regular routine. I like routine. You know, it's really helpful to me. So looking forward to it.
Did you get a lot of good response from the movie?
Yeah. I think there were probably 1,500 people there because the auditorium holds 2,500. And, you know, just from the look of it, I mean, it wasn't completely filled, but it was substantially filled. So I'm thinking 1,500 is probably right around the number that came. So yeah, it was a good evening. I had not seen the film up until that evening. So
any thoughts?
You know, well, I actually liked it. I mean, I think they did a really good job. I mean, it's dense. You know, they pack a lot of content into 70 minutes, but I think the visuals are good. The whole thing left me wishing like that I had a voice like Eric Mason. he's one of the scholars in the film that I met years ago and have been to his frequency conference in Philadelphia. But he just sounds so good. I almost texted him during the film, like, dude, you just sound great. Why can't I sound like you? Yeah. But no, they did a good job. People seem to really enjoy it, so I thought it was a really good event.
And Florida still treating you well?
Yeah. We had a tornado warning last night for a few hours, but I think it was really for the next county over. We got a few winds, you know, and we have a skylight, and so you could hear the rain a little bit more. Maury went under a table, so I guess it spooked him a little bit, but you know, nobody else, you know, was really affected.
All right, Mike. Well, hey, this is it. This is the end of the road. The last five chapters of Exodus. That's crazy. It's amazing. It's been probably right over a year, and I'm sure everybody needs a break from the book study.
Right. Nobody's going to want to watch the Ten Commandments anymore. You know, we've beaten it out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, don't forget, we probably have enough. I got to send you those questions, Mike, but we probably have enough for two Q&A episodes covering Exodus. So at least this will wrap up the actual book itself, and then we'll have two more. I'm cutting off the questions. So we appreciate everybody that sent in Exodus questions. But and then after this one, we'll have two more of Exodus Q&A. And then that'll be it. That'll be all she wrote. So you've got to go to nakedbiblepodcast.com, go to our store, and please buy a Book of Exodus sticker or shirt. Remember, you know, the Book of Exodus.
There you go.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
I love it. I love the...
Burn it into your memory right there.
Commemorate. Yeah, I love the little logo we have on it. So we've sold actually quite a bit of shirts and stickers on the Book of Exodus. So that's fun.
We should get one for Leviticus, you know, that says something like, if we can do this book, you know, the podcast is for real or something like that. I remember that was the challenge.
Yeah.
That's why we picked Leviticus first.
Yeah, I'm going to go back and create one for each one, so we will. But if you did get a Book of Exodus something, man, take a picture of it and hashtag it Naked Bible so we can see it out there. I'd like to see what people got or how they're using it or something. You know, it's fun. It's just fun.
Yeah.
But,
All right. Well, let's just jump in.
Let's do it.
Yeah, this is Exodus 35 to 40, as Trey said, and as we promised last week, one episode. And, you know, we might as well just start with the obvious observation, you know, to explain why we're doing it this way. And that is most of chapters 35 through 40 repeats material in chapters 25 through 31, which we went through in some detail. So we're not going to sort of reinvent the wheel and be repetitive. But I want to talk about this, you know, fact or this, you know, phenomenon that, you know, why is there so much material repeated at the end of the book, you know, that's already gone before? Like, what's the point with that? So just in general, to kind of summarize the issue, I want to jump into it this way. I'm going to read a little bit from Douglas Stewart's commentary on Exodus. And, you know, he kind of summarizes what's going on here. And then I'm going to do the same with a little bit from Pete Enns's commentary, just so, again, we get the feel for what it is we're looking at. So Stewart says, Exodus 35 through 40 contains a high proportion of the same material already revealed in chapters 25 through 31, but not in the same order. Okay. Several factors account for this reordering, most of which will be addressed, you know, in his commentary in detail. We're not going to get into all, you know, the whole thing because it's quite dense. But he says foremost among these factors as to why, again, there's reordering is the need to portray in chapters 35 through 40 how the various objects were actually constructed in order. In chapters 25 through 31, the call for Israelites to bring as donations materials out of which the tabernacle and its furnishings can be made is followed by a description of the objects themselves in the order of their importance and holiness. That is, moving from the most sacred, the Ark, which was a direct representation of Yahweh and the place of his contact with his people, to the least sacred, which was the courtyard perimeter. So that's the order you actually get in chapters 25 through 31. Stewart says, in chapters 35 through 40, by contrast, the objects are described in the order they were actually constructed, an order dictated by common sense and necessity. A modern analogy might be found in the difference between how a church might be described before being built and the order in which it would actually be built. If a church building committee were describing what they wanted their new church to be like, they might well start by describing the sanctuary, then perhaps certain other interior rooms, then perhaps the general external appearance, what sort of steeple or not might be desired, then the furnishings, the lighting, and other decor. But a builder could not build the church in that order. He would start with clearing the site, then pouring the footings, then a foundation, then sills, then the framing. The building committee's ordering of its desires would be completely appropriate, but so would the builder's ordering of the building process. The two orders are not the same, and no one who really understands the building process from conception to construction would expect them to be. The vision comes in one order, the implementation in another. So I think that's very reasonable, and again, for Stewart to point out, and probably helpful. I mean, there is a certain pragmatic difference between chapters 35 through 40 and, you know, what you read in Exodus 25 through 31. But it's more than just pragmatic construction issues as well. We're going to see that in this episode, but I want to throw in a little selection from Pete Enns's commentary here, again, to highlight the same issue, just putting things in a different way with a different angle. So Enns writes, chapters 25 through 40 manifest a basic structure. Chapters 25 through 31 record the instructions for building the tabernacle. Chapters 35 to 40, its actual building. Sandwiched between those two sections is, among other things, the story of the golden calf, a story of rebellion and eventual forgiveness. This is not just a story of any sort of rebellion, but of the Israelites attempting to set up an alternate cultic system to the one given in chapters 25 through 40. Note also another clear organizational element in these chapters. The rebellion section of chapters 32 through 34 is framed by passages on the importance of keeping the Sabbath, that's Exodus 31, 12 through 18, and 35, 1 through 3. So on the exact, you know, either side, you have these references to Sabbath. Enns continues, this is hardly an accident. Precisely what this structure means to communicate to the reader, however, is not spelled out in the narrative itself. the references to the Sabbath are intended to connect the building of the tabernacle to creation. Let me just jump in again. I mean, we saw a lot of that earlier when we were talking, when we had episodes in chapters 25 through 31, that there was this connection between Sabbath and creation and tabernacle. That there was a whole matrix of ideas that sort of played off one another. We're going to return to that in this episode a bit as well. So back to Enns, he says, you know, that the references here connect the building of the tabernacle to creation. Building the tabernacle, in other words, is an act of re-creation, culminating in the Sabbath command, a new seventh day, as it were. The close affinity between creation and Exodus, creation and redemption, is something we have seen throughout the book, so it is of no great surprise to see it developed here at its climactic stages, you know, right at the end of the book. Now, when we talked about these connections between Sabbath and creation and the tabernacle and the furnishings, you know, just the way the whole narrative plays out, we referenced an article by Kearney, that's K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, and it was referenced in two other sources that we used and that I put in the protected folder. One by Angel Manuel Rodriguez, it was an Andrews University Seminary Studies article, and another selection from Frank Gorman's book, The Ideology of Ritual, Space, Time, and Status in the Priestly Theology. So we're going to return to some of that material by way of, you know, reviewing a little bit of that material. Again, that's going to set up a little bit of how, you know, understanding, or at least how to think about the difference in order and the differentiation. You know, chapters 35 through 40 are mostly the same to chapters 25 through 31. There are differences. And then, of course, you have this order difference as well. So I'm going to review a little bit of what we covered before to help set up, you know, where we can go from here. So those two scholars, Rodriguez and Gorman, again, they referenced Kearney in some places, focused on literary analysis. They noted that we, for instance, have seen seven speeches in Exodus 25 through 31, which are dealing with the tabernacle. And lo and behold, you also happen to have seven utterances by Yahweh in Genesis 1 and 2, which are obviously about creation. So that's a literary comparison, just the way things are written. Seven speeches in one section, Exodus 25 to 31, seven speeches in Genesis 1 and 2. More specifically, though, the seven speeches giving instructions for proper activity in sacred space and for building the tabernacle parallel the seven acts of speech in the construction of the cosmos in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4. So it's more than just a number. It's more than just, hey, there's seven speeches in both things. Isn't that interesting? Well, if you actually look at the seven speeches, again, they give instructions for the formation and activity in sacred space, tabernacle, and the construction of the cosmos in Genesis 1 and 2. And of course, this plays into what we've talked about on a number of occasions. I mean, John Walton has done a lot of work here about how the cosmos, the creation account, is Yahweh essentially creating a temple. I mean, the cosmos is his temple, the earth is his footstool, you know, all this sort of imagery where Genesis 1 and 2 are really about the place where Yahweh is going to come to dwell with man. It's going to be his home, earth, you know, so there's this sacred space sort of element, this temple element, even to the creation of not only the cosmos, but even the earth. I mean, that you get the macro level, the cosmos, and then the earth is the footstool. You get the funneling down a little bit, Yahweh comes to earth itself. Again, that becomes his living space, you know, specifically in Eden, gets funneled even more in the Genesis account. So this is the kind of thing that, again, if you're looking to compare passages and you start noticing these patterns, these repetitions, it's not just about the number, seven of this, four of that, three of that, you know, it's not that. I mean, that's part of it, but the bigger part of it is thematic. That there are conceptual and thematic connections in these repetitive cycles. So Rodriguez, in his article, he gave us a few even more specific examples of how the seven speeches, again, with their creation elements, and they also include, you know, Sabbath. They end with the Sabbath. how those two sets, you know, parallel each other. Rodriguez wanted his readers to notice that if you look at these parallel sevens, you know, just the passages themselves, you'll notice another pattern or other patterns. There are 6 days plus a seventh day. So he writes, this is quoting him, 6 days plus a seventh day, according to Exodus 24, 15 through 17, Moses climbed Mount Sinai to receive instruction for the building of the sanctuary. He waited for 6 days, and on the seventh day, the Lord spoke to him from the theophanic cloud. The sequence of 6 days and a seventh day is the same we find in Genesis. It is uncertain whether the seventh day in this case was a Sabbath, in Moses' case, but the reference to 6 and 7 days suggests a connection between the two narratives. In both cases, the seventh day provided the time during which there's a special meeting between God and humans. Now, you know, elsewhere in Exodus, it's very clear that the Sabbath is part of this, and Rodriguez is going to point out some of that as well, and so is Gorman. The seven speeches of Exodus 25 through 31, in fact, close with Sabbath rest, just like the seven speech utterances of creation. Rodriguez writes, God gave Moses instructions concerning the building of the sanctuary through seven speeches introduced by the phrase, the Lord said to Moses. And then he has the verse references there, which I'm not going to repeat. You can look those up in a concordance or software. But that's the way that the speeches are telegraphed, okay? The seventh speech brings the instructions for the building of the sanctuary to a close and with a call to keep the Sabbath, Exodus 31, 13, and 17. In the creation narrative in Genesis, God spoke during 7 days and rested on the seventh day. It seems that this is the pattern that's being followed in the building of the tabernacle. Now, Durham, who is the author of the Word Biblical Commentary, which we've used before in this series, he's aware of all this. He knows that Rodriguez and Gorman are, you know, sort of playing off this earlier study by Kearney. And again, you could go back and listen to the earlier episodes where we quote more from Rodriguez and Gorman and mention Kearney's work again. Durham, again, writing the Word Biblical Commentary, he's aware of all this stuff because that's what scholars do when they write commentaries. They do literature reviews so that they know, you know, everything that's been written on the subject matter to that point. And then they can reference it or disagree with it or build upon it, so on and so forth. So Durham's assessment of this is interesting. He says, basically, I'm going to summarize him. There's a lot to like there. There's a lot to like in what Kearney and Rodriguez and Gorman are saying. But he's not entirely persuaded that all of that is sort of the point as to why we have this similarity and the differentiation in ordering for chapters 35 through 40 compared to chapters 25 through 31. And he writes as follows. So he's going to, you know, sort of hint at why he's not entirely persuaded. And then he's going to make his own, you know, contributions here. And then we're going to drill down into that. So Durham writes, according to Kearney's theory, chapters 25 through 31 present seven speeches of Yahweh to Moses based on the 7 days of creation. Chapters 35 to 40 echo this structure faintly in speeches made by Moses. Neither Kearney's theory or any of the others that focus on literary patterns, though, gives any satisfactory answer to the question of the similarities and differences of Exodus 25 through 31 and 35 to 40, despite their helpful illumination of a number of detailed points. What links Exodus 25 to 31 and 35 through 40 is not primarily a series of literary connections, Durham argues, but a series of theological ones. And at the heart of the theological connections is the ever-present, irreducible minimum of the book of Exodus, and that is the imminent presence of Yahweh. The similarities of Exodus 25 through 31 and 35 to 40 may all be accounted for on the basis of their rootage in this all-encompassing theme, again, the presence of Yahweh. Both sections, each in its own way, are preoccupied with Israel's need to experience the reality of Yahweh's presence. The differences between Exodus 25 to 31 and 35 to 40 may all be accounted for if four probabilities are kept in mind. Now, I'm going to list these four, but I think he's on to something here, not only because of what, you know, he's what we're going to get into in the next few minutes. But also, if you remember, the golden calf incident was really revolved around the lack of the presence of Yahweh, because he's up on the mountain with Moses, and who knows what happened to Moses. It's been 40 days. And the Israelite panic over that situation, and then their attempt through the building of the golden calf to, you know, re-presence Yahweh. You know, they're going to build this golden calf, thinking poorly, that this is going to usher in Yahweh's presence again, or attract him back, or something like that. I mean, they're a bit desperate because they can't go back. They can't go forward. They don't know what to do. They're just stuck at this mountain. They don't know what to do. Their leader's gone. The presence of Yahweh isn't evident for the last 40 days. So, you know, by golly, we're going to bring it back. We're going to do something here. And then they go to Aaron, you know, who's the logical person to go to make this happen. So even that revolves around this theme of presence. Now, Durham lists these four probabilities. Again, he says the difference is between, he's highlighting the differences now, between Exodus 25 to 31 and 35 to 40 may all be accounted for if four probabilities are kept in mind. Number one, he says Exodus 35 through 40 is based on the same theme as Exodus 25 to 31. Again, this imminence thing is central in his mind. But, he says, they follow a different order. Number two, Exodus 35 to 40 omits or adds material in comparison with Exodus 25 to 31 in relation to its own separate purpose and was not intended simply to duplicate chapters 25 through 31. Third, the obvious repetition of parts of Exodus 25 to 31 in Exodus 35 to 40, sometimes even verbatim, is for didactic and liturgical reasons, and perhaps also by reason of genre. But again, he's more tuned into the theological stuff. So he thinks it's didactic to teach people, you know, you learn by repetition. And he's thinking of the reader and the hearer here. And also liturgy, that again, these passages are going to be used in cultic ways. Again, and when the cult is doing anything, whether it's offering a sacrifice or celebrating something, it's all about the presence of Yahweh and what he has done. So again, he's fixated on this presence idea. And fourth, the two sections are seen as having developed along with both the Exodus composite and to a degree alongside each other, and are viewed in the context of Exodus as a whole rather than parts in isolation. Basically, to translate that into, you know, more normal English and not academese, he's saying, look, you can't really understand the parts without understanding the whole. The whole has to inform the parts. And again, his argument is that the whole of the book, all these sections, and, you know, really all the way back to the beginning, is about Yahweh dwelling among his people. It's about the imminent presence of Yahweh. So that for him is an overarching idea that he believes must be a central focus of explaining anything in these chapters, in the relationship of chapters 35 through 40 to 25 to 31. So I'm not going to drill down into everything he does, but we're going to drill down a little bit here just to give you sort of a sampling of how, you know, Durham thinks this should be approached. So his first observation, or his first probability, okay, that 35 through 40 is based on the same theme as Exodus 25 through 31, but 35 through 40, the presentation of the presence of Yahweh follows a different order, different way of doing it. So on that point, again, he says the theme of Yahweh's presence in Israel's midst is presented in Exodus 25, 31 by extending a call for the offering of materials worthy of symbolizing and remaining near Yahweh's presence. Okay, this is, think of the instructions to build the tabernacle and its furnishings. So there's an extension of a call for materials worthy of symbolizing the presence of Yahweh. Then following that call, there's a series of instructions for the preparation of such media, such materials, listed in a sequence moving from the most intimate of those symbols, the ark, to the symbol farthest from it, the temple court. So he's saying this is the way Exodus 25 through 31 telegraphs or gets us to think about the presence of Yahweh. He says the order is closed by the establishment of the command to keep the Sabbath as a sign of the uniqueness of a people among whom Yahweh is resident. Okay, God is resting, you know, building sacred space, just like in Genesis where he was with Adam and Eve, now he's among his people. So this is Exodus 25 through 31 with centered by the theme of Yahweh's presence. Now he says this about the other five, the other chapters, 35 through 40. He says, the theme of Yahweh's presence in Israel's midst is presented in these chapters in an order that begins with the Sabbath emphasis. You see, the other one ended with it. This one begins with the Sabbath emphasis. And that's Exodus 35, 1 through 3. It's the Sabbath, okay, Sabbath regulations. So it begins with Sabbath emphasis. Then it moves logically to the gathering of materials and the recognition of the artisans, to the actual construction of the tabernacle and its equipment and its court, to the preparation of the sacral vestments, what they're going to wear, of those who will minister in and join the three, you know, the circle of nearness here, on to the erection of the tabernacle and the climactic arrival onto it and in it of, guess what? Yahweh's presence. Into this sequence have been inserted two summary sections, one dealing with the precious metals used in the fulfillment of Yahweh's instructions, and one dealing with the fulfillment of all those instructions. So he's saying, you know, let's just take those two sort of intrusive summary sections out of the picture. You know, he basically says 35 through 40 in a significant way inverts 25 through 31, begins with the Sabbath, and it culminates in the presence of Yahweh. Again, whereas the other one begins with the call for materials that would be associated with deity. Okay. And we talked a lot about this, you know, with relation to, you know, objects that were made with gold and objects that were not made with gold. You know, the gold was there to telegraph the idea of the greatest sanctity. This is, you know, this is where the deity lives. This is what the stuff the deity uses, you know, most, you know, intimately or most directly, that sort of thing. So that's how Exodus 25 through 31 begins, you know, with that sort of note about or alert, you know, some a big header that signifies that, okay, now we're going to start talking about where Yahweh is going to live among us, where Yahweh's presence is going to dwell among us. That's how chapters 25 through 31 begins, and that it ends with the Sabbath. Chapters 35 through 40 begins with the Sabbath and ends with Yahweh actually coming into or upon, you know, in the cloud, the structure, that which was built. So again, he's saying this is how we need to understand this. It's not just these seven cycles of utterances and the literary sevens and taking us back to Genesis. He's, you know, Durham would say, look, all that's true. But the thing to really notice is the idea of Yahweh living among his people. That's how we should read why things are different, especially the order in chapters 35 through 40, as opposed to chapters 25 through 31. And even in those, you know, those two intrusive sections that he mentions, that you know, they're just kind of thrown in the middle there or in different places. He says even those, one of them deals with the precious metals, you know, the appropriate metals, and the other one is just sort of a summary of the fulfillment of Yahweh's instructions, that they did their job the way Yahweh told them to do it. So, you know, they're intrusive in a literary sense. They just show up in places and kind of mar the presentation. But he said they don't really mar the presentation if you ask yourself what they're about. They're still about presence, because, you know, even the second one about just doing your job the way God told you to do it, how many times have we seen, most recently with the golden calf episode, that Yahweh wants things done the way he wants them done and does not really tolerate improvisation, and he has reasons for that. So it's still an important section about him being among his people. Another issue, let's drill down on, Durham talks about the repetition again. So, you know, this is helpful again in Durham's mind. And I think, again, he's onto something, that we should be thinking about the presence of Yahweh to understand the different order of presentation. But what about the repetition? Durham writes this. He says, the redactor or the editor who brought Exodus into the form in which we know it must certainly have been aware of the similarities between the two sections, including the numerous points where the parallels are verbatim. I mean, like, how could you miss that? The fact that the repetition remains suggests some purpose for it. And given the essential nature of the theme underlying the two sections, that purpose may be understood as both didactic again, the instruction of Israel and Israel's priests concerning fundamental symbols and practices that were all too frequently either corrupted or abandoned. In other words, I'll just jump in here. In other words, he's saying, look, repetition is not only a memory aid here to get people to remember things, but repetition draws attention. So his argument is going to be, you know, for those who are dealing with the material in a written sense and who are, you know, most immediately involved in carrying out what it says, and not just on the ground, you know, when they're building the tabernacle and these and its furniture, but the priesthood generally, you know, who's going to be responsible for what's described in Exodus 25 through 40. The fact that so much is repeated should tell them, hey, you know, newsflash, this is important. It's so important that we're repeating a lot of it. Even though the order is different, we're still repeating a lot of it. So, like, attention here. It's just a way to highlight the importance of the material. So, Durham thinks that that's probably, you know, what's going on. And then they're also liturgical. So he says it's didactic, it's liturgical. The ordering of movement, this is Durham now, and perhaps also, you know, the way worship is conducted, by which Israel both asserted and reinforced faith, you know, in their liturgy, that, again, the fact that these things are reported, not only are recorded twice, not only says, hey, this is important, but a lot of that stuff does involve and will involve liturgical practices, you know, the certain objects, the ark, the altar, you know, these are going to be associated with sacrifice, for instance, you know, that you get. Of course, this is obviously the role of the priest. So it has a lot to do with making sure the liturgy is correct and understood when the information in Leviticus, you know, comes around. So I think, again, he's got, you know, he's got some decent points here, again, to help us understand this. He references Cassuto, Umberto Cassuto, which is was a famous Jewish scholar. Who wrote some commentaries on Genesis and Exodus. Cassuto has suggested also the influence of the ancient Near Eastern genre of the giving of divine instructions, which are then reported as carried out by a detailed repetition of the instructions. So you actually see this in the ancient Near East, where a deity will give instructions to priests or people or whoever, and then, you know, the instructions are, you know, carried out, they're enacted, and then repeated. Kind of like, you know, very similar to what you have here. Cassuto's example, Durham notes, is the Ugaritic account of King Keret's dream, in which El gives instructions subsequently followed by Keret and then repeated nearly verbatim in the account of his accomplishments, the king's accomplishments. So Cassuto's argument is saying, look, you know, that we see this kind of thing elsewhere. And so maybe, you know, that's part of what we're looking at here. Maybe it's a, you know, it is a literary thing. Maybe it's just a genre conformity here. So Durham, you know, again, is willing to throw that in here, but, you know, if you push him to the wall, he's going to opt for it's didactic, it's liturgical. The repetition is designed to draw attention and importance, make sure that the duties are carried out correctly, and it's all about the presence of Yahweh. So it's nice of him to include that because, you know, we like ancient Near Eastern parallels. But at the end of the day, you know, for Durham, it's more about those other things than it would be a literary or genre consideration. He also talks about the fact that chapters 25 through 31 and 35 through 40, how they need to be seen as complementary of one another as well. He writes, the questions of which section is nearer to a supposed forlaga, that's a supposed original, like which one came first, since a lot of the content is identical, which one was written first. And we would tend to think that they're writing things in order of chapters, but there were no original chapter, you know, divisions and things like that. So he's saying the question of which section is nearer to the original and of how one section can be seen to presuppose or to supplement the other tend to draw attention away from the manner in which the two sections complete each other, as instruction and obedience, as promise and fulfillment. Yahweh instructs Moses and gives him the visionary pattern of his intentions in chapters 25 through 31. Moses passes along the instructions and his understanding of them as they are carried out in chapters 35 through 40. The first sequence begins with the call for materials. The second begins with the offering of these materials. The first section ends with instructions for the priest's ordination, then is followed by a sequence of supplemental material, which ends with an emphasis on keeping the Sabbath as a sign of the special relationship founded on Yahweh's presence. The second sequence ends with the advent of Yahweh's presence onto and into the newly built and erected tabernacle, an authentication of the symbols, and an authorization of the beginning of worship with them. In sum, there is an intercomplementary relationship between Exodus 25 to 31 and Exodus 35 to 40 throughout, one that links these sections far more closely and far more consequentially than has generally been assumed. Now, in my view, I think all of these observations are worthwhile. There's no like cosmic rule or expectation that there's only one goal of a writer. You know, like we have to choose between, well, was what he was doing a literary exercise or a theological one? The answer is yep. Okay, you know, because one thing is going to contribute to the other. The other is going to inform the other one. They're going to be complementary. They're going to telegraph, you know, certain ideas to the people, whether that's an inversion of the order of events in one section and then the reversal in another. Or again, certain things getting repeated verbatim, again, that would let them know that, hey, this is important. All of these things are on the table. At least they should be on the table. They are all strategies. They're strategies that move in different directions, but they complement and complete one another. They you know, present a fuller picture of, you know, the ideas, you know, a small subset of ideas that the writer did want to communicate. So sometimes the best way to communicate that is through repetition. Sometimes it's through difference, you know, changing things up, again, like order. Writers have different strategies. They don't always use the same strategy, the same way, in the same place. They just don't. Again, there's no cosmic rule that we have to pick. Well, you know, is this literary or theological or something else, okay? There's no rule that tells us what to do there. You know, they're different strategies for communicating important and, in this case, related points. Now, the takeaway for all this, you know, in this episode, and we're going to wrap up, you know, with this, I'm going to say, you know, a few things here. You say, well, you know, I don't want you to think of this as Bible trivia. I don't want you to think of this as sort of, you know, okay, you know, we can understand, you know, what's going on when we read these chapters. We'll remember, you know, okay, the order is one way in chapters 25 to 31, different Exodus 35 to 40. That's kind of a neat little scholastic exercise. You know, thank you, Mike, for that. There's actually a more significant application to this and to things like it that we've seen in the book. So I'm going to say a few things here. Number one, recognizing patterns helps us to discern points, themes, and ideas of central importance. In this case, creation, Sabbath, and Yahweh's presence. Okay? So again, this is why I have said in the past, you would get more out of your Bible if you read it like it was fiction, especially narrative. Because when you read fiction, you automatically assume that the writer is doing something deliberately to you. That there's intent. It's not just a travelogue. It's not just an itinerary. Okay, when you read fiction, you know that you're being played with by the writer. And so if we would go into reading narrative in scripture that way and know from the outset, it's not just a travelogue. It's not just, you know, a list of this and that. It's not just, you know, the guy who wrote this was probably bored that day and wasn't thinking anything, you know? No, the writers of scripture are intentionally trying to do things to their readers. And they will use certain techniques to draw attention to important themes and ideas. And they use all sorts of strategies for doing this. Now, number two, the patterns are intentional. And since that's the case, they don't often conform to linear storytelling. This means that we ought not judge the coherence of a passage or even a section of a book or a section of scripture based on our expectations of how stories should be told or how narratives should be written. You know, in a lot of cases, we let our modern bias influence our judgment and our assessment of stuff that's in the Bible. Okay, you know, let's just be honest. Not only didn't you write it, but the person who did write it and the hands, you know, again that went into giving it to us in its final form, they were thinking specific things and they were, you know, doing things to the text of Scripture to highlight and communicate certain ideas and themes for their audience. They were doing intentional things. And if they need to change the order of something, even though the content is identical, they're going to do it. They're going to decide how best to draw attention to X, Y, or Z. So it doesn't really matter that, oh, this isn't the way that, you know, this isn't the way that intelligent writers today would write narrative. Therefore, the person who wrote this in the Bible was just a hack or just didn't know what they were doing. You know, that is just a modern conceit. That's what that is. Which brings me to my third point. Consequently, the person who compares these two sections, Exodus 25 to 31, Exodus 35 to 40, and charges the writers and editors with errors when differences arise, well, that person judges incompetently, and I would say even stupidly. This is what happens a lot in biblical criticism. You have your source critics. Again, these are the people who are just fixated on, you know, I see a difference in the text. That must be a different source. Where did those sources come from? Let me speculate now. Okay, let me compare the sources that I've come up with in this section when I see other differences in some other section. Maybe, like, can I match these sources up? You know, how do I do that? And then they try, and by golly, they succeed, you know, in their own minds. I mean, they're going to make their case, you know, for, you know, whatever. This is why I think JEDP is so often circular in reasoning, but, you know, I don't want to drift off into that. But look at what's happening in that. They're looking at differences, again, the source critics, and they're asking a question, hey, this, where are the sources? Because they assume that this must be the explanation. And this is why historically, the next sort of wave of biblical criticism was literary criticism, applying literary approaches to the Torah instead of the source critical thing. This is why those two schools in the early days of, you know, critical study of Scripture, they didn't like each other. Okay. Because the literary critics would say, you people are out to lunch. Okay. You're just speculating. You can't really prove this. Oh, it might. You know, it sounds like a nice idea to say this or that source from this or that time. Okay, you know, none of us here are really committed to any form of Mosaic authorship. So we'll, you know, go ahead and run with that. Some of this sounds good. Some of it just sounds nutty. But we have a better way of approaching this. We're, you know, it's literary analysis. And, you know, nowadays there's a bit more of a friendly relationship between the two. They're trying to sort of come together in terms of their approach and the implications, you know, for each and so on and so forth. But here's the bigger point. People, even when they, I'll just zero in the literary criticism thing here, even when they can see that there are literary reasons why a writer does this or that or the other thing, there's still this temptation to judge it. And honestly, I'm just thinking that's really, I think, out of place, because it's just not coherent for you to judge the end result of a thing produced in literary terms as being erroneous or containing errors or conflicting with something else, when the literary artistry should tell you that that was never their intention. They're not writing stuff so that it conforms to this other stuff in every possible way, in every detail, in the order of detail. It's just not even on the table for them. Okay, what they're trying to do is something different. Oftentimes, writers will change a detail just so that you notice it. And then it's mission accomplished for them. Aha, we've drawn your attention because you read it this way over here, and now you're reading it this other way. Well, we hope that you'll figure out why we changed it, why we added something, why we took something out, why we changed an order, because we want you to think about what you're reading. We want you to assume that we, the writers and editors, are trying to draw your attention, to get you to notice something. That's the whole point. And so for us to say they goofed in different places is really to misunderstand their goal. So this is a bit of a hobby horse with me, because I don't see why the observation of the artistry cannot and should not give us a better appreciation for the intelligence of the writer, not less appreciation for the intelligence of the writer. Or I don't see how it would build the assumption that, you know what, we can sit in judgment on the writer because, you know, we're just better. Like, we just know better. We would do this a different way and it would be a better way. Those are modern conceits. That's what they are. So I think we need to realize this, that a lot of, you know, this is my fourth observation. This is why, you know, not on everything, but on a lot of these sorts of things, when it comes to the question of inerrancy, I suspect, it's just a suspicion. I don't have anything to base this on, like empirical research or something. But I suspect that evangelicals who abandon the idea of inerrancy do so far too quickly when it comes to this kind of material. They come across inconsistencies. You know, hey, Exodus 35 through 40, is, you know, they have lots of differences between that and chapters 25, 31. Even though they're talking about the same stuff, there's lots of inconsistencies here. This comes before that. That's not the way it was. It's like the Synoptic Gospels, too. The Synoptic Gospels do this in terms of like the order of events and whatnot. And so we encounter this, and it looks to us like there's clear inconsistencies here. And in one sense, there are. But the question is, did they goof? Or is it deliberate? And I think a lot of, you know, evangelicals who are sort of willing to jettison just the concept of inerrancy, okay, do so without even asking that question. And that is a question that needs to be asked. Is there some way to think about this where we can see intelligence, intentionality behind what we can, as the reader, remove, you know, 2,000 years removed, we notice an inconsistency here. Is it possible that that's there for a reason? It's intentional. And when you get into literary analysis, like we've just sort of illustrated here with these last, you know, several chapters, the answer is yeah. You know, there are people who really invest a lot of time at a real nuts and bolts level in the text, you know, to discern what might be the whole point here of the inconsistency. It's not a goof. It's designed specifically to draw your attention to something. So that is a question that needs to be asked, you know, why the inconsistency might be there. So just in the book of Exodus, you know, we've seen a number of places, you know, this episode and other episodes where that's really what's going on. So let's not be distracted. Well, I'll end with this. Let's not be distracted by the, you know, I use the phrase village atheist, you know, out there on the internet. You know, I'm sure you're going to find websites that, you know, compare Exodus 35 through 40 and 25 to 31. Oh, look at all these errors. You know, it's this way here and that way there. Look at these errors. Oh, just so many errors. I can't just grasp. I can't comprehend the magnitude of the stupidity of the biblical writers. You know, look at, they're just goofing everywhere. And those people are so underinformed that they never even ask the question, might this be intentional? And then, you know, when you ask that question and you actually, you know, get into scholarship and you see that, yeah, you know, you can really build a good case that this is intentional. Then the question changes, you know, to not how dumb was the writer, but how dumb am I, okay, to not ever have considered this possibility. But typically out there on the internet world of Bible, you know, hating or Bible criticizing, you often don't find that level of introspection or honesty when it comes to this. And some of that's a sourcing problem. You know, they don't look for good source. You know, I get it. You know, this is the world I live in all the time. So I understand that there's an exposure problem here. But I'm hoping that this episode and some of the other stuff we've covered at least exposes you to the fact that there is an exposure problem with those who would criticize Scripture along these lines. You know, and I'm not saying there aren't any problems, there aren't any, you know, impasses or, you know, really tough, you know, situations or you know, I mean, those things are out there, they exist, but their number is dramatically reduced when we're at least willing to ask the question, might this be intentional? might this be, you know, some literary thing that's going on here? Strategy. Because in a lot of cases, it's like, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And it might take a book or a dissertation or some, you know, journal article to ferret that out for you. But there's a lot of this stuff to consider. And again, I think a lot that just helps generally helps us think better about Scripture. And to me, that has apologetic value. So I'm hoping that's what you take away from this last episode.
And just like that, Mike, we're done. Congratulations.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Just I won't say it was a blink of an eye. Just like that.
How's it feel?
Feels good. I'm ready for some Q&A now, Trey. Bring it on.
Oh man, I don't know how I think about it, how I feel about it. It'll take me a little bit to process it. I'm so used to typing Exodus and thinking about Exodus. And...
I'm so used to typing Exodus. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Wow. All right. Well, congratulations. That's a milestone. That is a milestone. So, all right. Well, we appreciate it. Yeah, sounds good. All right. Well, I've got all the questions I can handle, or Mike can handle, that is. So be looking forward to the Exodus Q&As next week. And with that, Mike, we appreciate it. And thank you. Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.